Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin and Gary Spain. Coming up on this week's show, we're on a new journey as we look at the Northern Ireland international team from 1920 through to 1939 as we begin talking about Northern Irish football at club and international level, as well as League of Ireland and Republic of Ireland international football too. Remember to share the show on your own social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. We're also available across the spectrum of podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, YouTube, and much more. And make sure to turn your notifications on so you can get notified of when the podcast goes live on whatever platform you listen to us on. And while you're there, give us 5 stars to show how much you love the show. So let's get on with this week's show. So, Gary, we're changing tact on the podcast this time around because we've talked a lot, obviously, about Irish football and its history and its pedigree, etc. But it's always been kind of, I suppose, centered around the Republic of Ireland football team and the League of Ireland, etc. But we wanted to kind of start talking about Northern Ireland football as well, because that's probably just as important on the island of Ireland as well, in terms of, I suppose, number one, the pedigree of players that it's put out over the past kind of 100 years, etc. as well. But also, obviously, because its domestic league is right next door to us as well. We're going to start off probably around about 1919, 1920. And as we kind of touched on in previous podcasts, it's a very upheaval time, I suppose, in Northern Ireland football at the time, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we had the split, but we also had, at that time, the War of Independence was going on. That was followed by the Civil War south of the border. So I think it's fair to say there was less upheaval in what's now Northern Ireland. So Northern Ireland was obviously founded in, whatever, 1921. But there was less upheaval in Northern Ireland. There was more of the issues and trouble were south of the border. And I don't want to rake over the coals of the split again, but part of the reasoning was that it was deemed unsafe to play certain games in Dublin, whereas it was able to continue as normal in Belfast.
When you look at it as well, it's probably in the shadow of World War One as well, which has just finished 2 or so odd years ago from it as well. So it's very much a time in Northern Ireland of trying to get to grips with, I suppose, the things that are happening around it, in it, and trying to make football work within that space as well.
Yeah, I mean, football was just coming back to normal after the end of World War One. I mean, after Ireland or Northern Ireland, as it is now, the IFA won the home championship in 1914. Football was suspended, so it didn't get to play again until 1919. And obviously, the world had a very different landscape at that point. And I should point out as well that the only internationals being played at the time by the IFA, or up to this point, had all been against the other home nations. So they played the home championship every season, and they played England, Scotland and Wales, and on alternate years they were either at home or away.
Yeah, and so we kind of touched on it before as well in previous podcasts, but explain to us a little bit about the home nations. Just give us a little bit of a quick refresher. What were they, and kind of how significant were they?
So it was hugely significant. It was the first ever international football tournament. And I mean, the first international was Scotland, England in 1872. The home championship, so the IFA was founded in 1880, and they started playing games against Scotland, Wales and England. And I think it was 1884 the home championship was first played for between the four nations. And I mean, right up into the 20s and the 30s, the time we're going to talk about, I mean, they would have considered themselves superior to football around the world. And we can go on and talk about the early World Cups, but it is no relevance to Northern Ireland because they didn't enter. England didn't enter, Scotland didn't enter, etc. So, but the home championship was a hugely, hugely prestigious tournament. And it was a huge deal in 1914. When Ireland, because it was an all-Ireland team, became champions for the first time. And that included, as we talked about before, the 3-0 win over England at Earson Park, which became known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And talked about the players, the huge influence, those south of the border as well as north of the border, who contributed to this great win. I mean, there was Patrick O'Connell. I'm going to leave somebody out. There was Val Harris, Patrick O'Connell from Dublin, Sandy Craig from Galway. I mean, we talked about some of those before. But they were the contributors to this title win in 1914.
Yeah, and ironically, I suppose you could call it an all-Ireland team, really, couldn't you? I mean,
there was players from
the South playing in, I suppose, what you consider Northern Ireland's team.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, you can consider the team up until 1950 to be an all-Ireland team, because the IFA never stopped picking players from south of the border. They continued, maybe a bit around the split, maybe not, but certainly from the seat, there was many southern players in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s that played for Northern Ireland, and many were dual internationals. They also played for what is now the Republic of Ireland. But certainly the team in 1914, there was one football association on this island. There was one national team. There was one effectively country on this island in 1914, obviously part of the UK. But that Ireland team was an all-Ireland team that won the home championship. And we may refer to it now as Northern Ireland, but Northern Ireland didn't exist at the time. Mm,
that's true, yeah. Mm. So give us a little, I suppose, window into who this kind of Northern Ireland team are at this kind of point in the early 20s. Like, who are the players and maybe talk to us a little bit about how good or how bad this team was.
Well, it depends what way you look at it. If you look at there's a few interesting stories. There's some great players I will talk about, more focus on the centre forwards. But if you look at the home championship tables, you would have to say of the four home nations, Northern Ireland were clearly the least successful. I mean, Wales were incredibly successful in the 20s. They won a few home championships in the 20s and into the 30s. They were very successful. Scotland were hugely successful. They won a number. They were, in fact, if anything, the dominant team at the time. And England, of course, were always there or thereabouts winning home championships. So with a few exceptions, and I will talk about the positives, you would have to say that in the 1920s and 1930s, Northern Ireland were very much fourth best. But having said that, there were some glorious moments. And you can even start with the first game back after the war was a 1-1 draw with England. And Northern Ireland did go on a 10-year unbeaten run at home against England, which was quite an achievement.
Wow.
And that included a couple of wins in 1923 and 1927. And actually up until David Healy scored that incredible goal in Windsor Park in 2005, England hadn't lost on Irish soil since 1927. So there was a long wait. There weren't too many in Windsor Park that day that would have been around in 1927 for the 2-0 win.
Yeah, and I suppose there's probably similarities there with the Republic of Ireland in terms of we were kind of surrounded by, I suppose, two dominant forces of football at the time, which was Scotland and England, and it was always kind of essentially where were you going to end up if they didn't end up at the top. That so it was always that kind of I suppose that kind of juxtaposition between us and them as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, in particularly England, I suppose, I mean, even to this day, most Irish football fans, it might be somewhat controversial, but it's the truth, most Irish football fans support an English team. It's Liverpool, it's Man United, it's Leeds United, whoever it is, most people. In fact, if you stop people in the street, even today in Limerick or Dublin or Cork, and you ask them, which football team do you support? It's rare you would hear Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne, Cork City, Galway United. You're much more likely to have Liverpool, Manchester United, Leeds United, Arsenal, Tottenham, whoever it is. So that's the reality. That's what it is. And I mean, I suppose, and many of us even look to the great days of our national team, certainly from Republic's point of view, Goodison 49, Stuttgart 88. From the Northern Ireland perspective, they would certainly talk about David Healy in Windsor Park. I mean, they beat Spain a year later in Windsor Park, Healy got a hat-trick. He got a hat-trick, and that was an incredibly good Spanish team. But I think there's more talk about the win over England in 2005.
Yeah, and look, listen, we both go to League of Ireland games and stuff like that as well, and there's always a young lad there with a Liverpool jersey on or a Manchester United jersey turning up to Galway or Cork or Shelburne or something like that. But I suppose that's just the way it is, the proximity, etc. But in terms of Northern Ireland and this football team, how did they progress through the 20s? And I suppose give us a little insight into some of their, I suppose, their more famous results in that time, as you said.
Yeah, so I mean, the first home championship back was 1919-1920. It was played on the English football season basis, by the way. So some of the games were in the early part of the year, the late part of the year, and then went on into the following season. So it normally finished around April, May time frame. So as I said, Wales won the first championship back after the war. Northern Ireland actually drew with them 2-2 in Belfast and got that draw against England. But Wales went to London and beat England, and that won the championship for them. Actually, they still needed England to beat Scotland, but they duly obliged. So, I mean, Northern Ireland finished bottom the following year, lost all three games. Not a huge, if you go into the early 20s, in the home championship, 21-22, they finished bottom again, did manage a couple of draws. As I said, England in Belfast in October 21, they got a draw there and drew at home to Wales. I suppose what I would like to talk about in 1922 was pretty historic. In May 22, Northern Ireland played a first international against foreign opposition. And it was arranged at reasonably short notice. And, well, there is some controversy around this as well, but the official records in Northern Ireland consider this a full international, and so it should be. So the IFA got a telegram in May 1922 from the Norwegian Football Association, and the telegram still exists. And they were asked to send a squad of 14 players to play two games in Norway in 1922, which was a full international in Bergen on the 25th of May, and play a provincial select in Christiania on the 28th, which is modern day Oslo. It changed its name to Oslo in 1925. So the IFA actually asked them to send £800 to cover the expenses. They agreed to play the two matches, and they picked what they said was the strongest available squad based on passports. Now, it does appear to have been a home-based squad. I think all the players are from Irish league clubs, but it was a mix of amateurs and professionals, and this is where the controversy gets in. But the telegrams still exist, and there was no mention of amateur players or professional players in the telegrams. So the IFA sent their team. They actually lost 2-1 to Norway in May 1922, which was the first time they, as I said, played foreign opposition. And they went on 3 days later to play the select game in what's now Oslo. The reason the games are somewhat controversial is Norway also played France and I think lost 7-0 in Stavanger the same year. In 1922, Norway wrote to FIFA and asked for the games to be annulled because they claimed that Northern Ireland played professional, which is correct. They did play professional players, some professional players, but there was no mention of that. And there was also some discrepancies in the French game. So unbeknown to Northern Ireland and the IFA, those games were scrubbed from the records by FIFA. And I think it wasn't discovered for 50, 60, 70 years after that.
Wow.
But the IFA still considered them. They awarded caps for them.
So is the controversy here that Norway wasn't expecting to play against professionally paid players, and so they didn't see it as a legitimate game, or what's where's the controversy with it?
Yeah, so that seems to be the issue. So Norway, football in Norway at the time would have been 100% amateur. So they wouldn't, but they didn't specify to the IFA that they were expecting just to play an amateur international. I mean, the IFA actually sent an amateur team to France a year or two before, I think it was 2 years before that. But that was to play a French amateur team. But from the telegrams, this was clearly a request to send a full international side, to send the strongest side. And in those days, in the IFA in Northern Ireland, that would have included professional players. So it's clearly a miscommunication. I think Norway possibly want, but also the program for the game exists, and it's listed as, it appears to say it's a full international as well. Hmm. So, but maybe they didn't realize, I suppose they wanted to play their full international team, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's some of it's probably buried in the mist of time, bits of time, but certainly Northern Ireland and the IFA consider it full international, and rightly so in my book.
Yeah, and I suppose if you just go by the telegram alone, I mean, if you turn around, if you're an international and you go, hey, does your international team want to play our international team? And that's it, without any kind of general, you know, bona fide specifics in there, you kind of take it as given that, yeah, they want to come play whatever that team looks like.
Okay. So one more thing I think that needs to be mentioned, and probably in fairness to FIFA and the Norwegian FA, that the regulations at the time did not seem to recognize amateurs playing against professionals. So I think a few years after that, it did change and those internationals were allowed. So that's probably why FIFA agreed to annul the internationals, because there would have been some professionals in the Northern Ireland team and the Norwegian team would have been 100% amateur.
Yeah, and I suppose, do we know kind of what the feeling was about playing this kind of international that didn't involve any of the home nations? Were people excited about it? Did they think it was great that they were going to play another team that wasn't one of the home nations?
No, it didn't. There doesn't seem to have been. I'm just looking back at contemporary newspaper reports, and there wasn't a lot in the newsletter. They did mention the request, which seemed to come about only about 10. This was only arranged about 10 days in advance. So obviously people had to take time off work. Some people, and they did caveat that some people didn't have passports and wouldn't have been able to get passports in time, because, of course, they wouldn't have needed. In fact, I would suspect most players didn't have passports because they wouldn't have needed a passport to play against Scotland, Wales or England. And it's very, very unlikely people would have been traveling abroad to Europe in those days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of the home nations, then again, I suppose it's another disappointing.
So we're bottom again. There were no wins. There was a draw with England and a draw with Wales. But again, finished rock bottom of the home championship in 1922. So it was a disappointing season again, yeah.
By comparison then, in 1923, they had a good run at the British Home Nations Championship, didn't they?
Yeah, so I mean, they lost 2-0, a 2-0 defeat to England at West Brom and lost at home to Scotland, but did go to Wrexham on the last day and thumped the Welsh 3-0, which was, I suppose, quite an impressive result and an impressive performance. And it also meant that the Welsh finished bottom instead of Northern Ireland, which was a nice change. And
small victories.
Small victories. And it continued again, actually, the following year, because Northern Ireland won on opening day. They beat England 2-1 in Belfast. As I said, the long unbeaten record against England. Now, they unfortunately lost away to Scotland, lost at home to Wales, but again managed to avoid the wooden spoon. And the team that actually finished bottom in 1924 was England, which I don't think happened too often in the home championship.
Did not know. But that result against England is a really big result, though, isn't it? I mean, we often put it, but England was the pedestal, wasn't it? They were always kind of in and around top of the food chain.
Absolutely. I mean, the win in 1913 in Belfast was the first ever win over England. So this was only the second one. I'll go on to talk about 1927, which was the third ever one, and David Healy in 2005. Sorry, at home wins, the home wins in Belfast. There were away wins in 1914, in the 1950s, the 1970s. So that's the away wins are a different matter. But the four England's four defeats on this island were in 1913, 1923, 1927, and 2005. Unfortunately, the Republic of Ireland have never beaten England in Dublin unless you count the 1995 abandoned game, but that's for another
another podcast. Talk to us about the where the home games were played. Was it the Oval? Was it Windsor Park? Did it kind of move around, or was it always Windsor Park?
So they weren't always in Windsor Park in those days. So Windsor got quite a few games. And I should actually talk about another game in 1924, which is also one that was a little bit shrouded in controversy and it's probably flipped status. But some of this is down to people not knowing the full story. But so this game was actually played at Cliftonville. So some games were played at Windsor. Cliftonville hosted some games. Celtic Park hosted some games. I'll go on to talk about a very, very famous game at Celtic Park. But in 1924, South Africa came on a tour of these islands. They actually played Bohemians in Dublin as well. And they played in what is now considered the first ever international for South Africa. And oh, wow. at the time, it was played as a senior full international in Belfast. Somehow, in the record books, it got classed as an amateur international. Back at the time, there were some things to say it was professional. One, there were professional players played in it, so they wouldn't have been eligible to play in an amateur international. Two, Northern Ireland played in blue shirts, which they played in at the time up until the 1930s. The amateur side played in green shirts. And three, the players were allowed to keep their shirts, which wasn't allowed for the amateur players. So certainly the side that played South Africa in 1924 was a full international side, but for some reason, and I'm not sure in the facts or whatever happened, it got listed as an amateur game, and it only got changed about 20, just it's actually this century, the early part of this century, wow, that the proper research was done again, and it was reclassified as a full international. FIFA recognized it as a full international, and South Africa recognized it as their first ever full senior international. And they actually beat Northern Ireland in Belfast as well at Solitude.
Can I ask you as well, as a football historian, etc., why do you feel things like that are important? In other words, being able to revise something and go, actually, that is a full international. Why is that important? And I suppose, why isn't that important to a country who's involved?
Well, I think it's very important to get it right. I mean, it's the history of the game. And I mean, these players, some of the players on that team were professional players. So they can't really be classed as amateurs. And it wasn't an amateur international. And it was just something that was wrongly recorded at some point in a reference book and suddenly got picked up by everything after that and left as amateur. And I think it is important to go back and correct the record. And also obviously the players who played in 1924 are no longer with us. But I mean, their descendants, their families, perhaps in some cases, I don't know off the top of my head, perhaps in some cases they were the only caps those players got. So it's important to be recognized. And I will go back to the Republic of Ireland, the Irish Free State as it was then. Obviously last year we recognized the 1924 Olympics as being senior internationals, and the subsequent games against Estonia and the USA. And I mean, certainly the USA was definitely wrongly classified as an amateur because we played professional players that were ineligible for the Olympics. So I don't want to go back through that rabbit hole again, but I think it's very important to get it right and to recognize the players that did play at a senior level for Northern Ireland, or Ireland as it was then.
Yeah, and I suppose from that point of view as well, it's it's also the accomplishment of getting to play for your country, really, isn't it? Because you're part of the 1% of the 1% that gets to play professional and at that top level.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and it's another thing to bear in mind is there were so fewer games in those days, and obviously so fewer caps. I mean, I'll go on and talk about a record cap holder, but I mean, the world record was a guy called O.M. Stanfield, who I think was it 20 caps off the top of my head? He held, a Northern Ireland player, an Irish player, held the world record back in the 1890s. And so, I mean, players today are getting to 50 caps, 75 caps, 100 caps. That was unheard of in those days. I mean, Elisha Scott set the Ireland record of 31 in 1936, and he had an incredibly long career with Liverpool, with Ireland, etc. So, I mean, even earning one cap in those days was quite an achievement, because there weren't that many games. And these days we play so many friendlies, so many qualifiers, competitive games. A lot more players get capped. So there were certainly some very good players. I'll go on to talk about some of the others at the time. Some incredible players who were very fortunate just to get a single cap, or get no, some got none at all.
Yeah, interesting stuff. We're into 1925 then, and 25 and 26. So where's Northern Ireland now in terms of their team and how they're playing?
So probably, unfortunately, losing in 25, finished bottom again, did get a scoreless draw in Wrexham, but that was the only point for the home championship. 26 was significantly better. Again, the home draw with England in October 25, so that would have been a four-match home unbeaten run against England. A 3-0 win over Wales, which was very impressive. And went to Glasgow with a chance, with basically... In February 26, the home championship was on the line in Glasgow between Scotland and Northern Ireland. Scotland still had to go to Manchester as well, but they effectively ended Northern Ireland's interest with a 4-0 win. So it was pretty comprehensive, but at least Northern Ireland got to play for the championship, which was the first time since 1914 that they were in contention for it.
Yeah, and it's... go on.
Should mention England finished bottom again, and Scotland were home champions.
you just didn't want to pass that up, did you? where do we see kind of Northern Ireland developing throughout the 20s? We kind of have them, they have a smattering of good results throughout the decade and things like that as well, but are they going places? Do we see a kind of a development, a plan, a program or something like that that's going to bring Northern Irish football kind of further forward?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there were some impressive results, but what I would say at the time was there were some incredible strikers being developed and coming on the scene. So I can talk about, I mean, I'm going to talk about four in particular, and for listening to this, if anyone I left out, but in no particular order, I'll talk about. I mean, there was Sammy Curran of Belfast Celtic, known as Blind Sammy because he only had eyes for goal, and he was a phenomenal goal scorer with Belfast Celtic. He only got four caps for Northern Ireland. I think he scored three goals, and including the winner in 1928. When Northern Ireland went to Glasgow and beat Scotland 1-0 at Fair Hill, actually at Partick Thistle, that game was played. And Blind Sammy got the only goal. I should mention another to be Belfast Celtic man, although he wasn't at the time, was the legendary Liverpool goalie Elisha Scott, who we talked about in previous podcasts. It was his display of goalkeeping at the other end that, and obviously Sammy's goal, that won the game for Northern Ireland. And saying it was an incredible performance, an incredible win. So I think you will talk about more so the odd wins, the odd great goals. But Blind Sammy, he also got a couple of goals as Belfast Celtic defeated Glasgow Celtic in 1926 in a friendly. He went on and played for Derry City. He played in Derry City's first ever game first ever professional senior game in 1929. He scored Derry City's first ever hat-trick in, I think it was their second or third game. And just an all-in-all legendary player. And when he retired, just ran a sweet shop in Bangor. Another goal scorer, legendary goal scorer, is Glentoran's Fred Roberts, who still holds the British Isles, these islands record of 96 goals in a single season. Fred Roberts got one cap. One cap.
Sorry, hold on a second. You go back to that again? He scored how many goals in a season?
96.
How do you score 96 goals in a season?
There were some incredible goal scorers in those days, and I mean...
And some pretty shoddy defences by the sounds of it.
And some pretty shoddy defences. And I mean, so Fred Roberts got 96, and he scored a lot of goals in other seasons as well. He got one cap. It was a nil-all draw against Scotland in, I think it was 1930-31. And it was a dreadful game. It was in Belfast, actually, in February 31. Dreadful game. He didn't play that well, and he never got another chance. And I mean, I know it rankles, or did rankle, with Glentoran fans at the time, because I talked about a great Belfast Celtic goal scorer, I talked about a great Glentoran goal scorer, and I have to talk about Joe Bambrick, who was probably better than any of them. And the reason Fred Roberts didn't get his chance was because the front line was Jimmy Dunn, who we'll talk about from a Dublin and Belfast perspective. But Joe Bambrick is arguably the greatest goal scorer of all time for Northern Ireland. He scored an incredible 6 goals in a 7-0 win over Wales in 1930 at Celtic Park. Went on an incredible career, scoring hundreds of goals for Linfield. Head, heel, or toe, slip it to Joe became, it was so well known, everybody knew it at the time. That was the line from the Linfield faithful. He was an incredible goal scorer. I think he got 11 caps, 12 goals, but it was quite an achievement in those days, even to get 11 caps for Northern Ireland. And he's still remembered to this day as probably one of the greatest Linfield players, one of the greatest Northern Ireland players of all time. It might not be popular in Glentoran circles, but
but it's,
he was an incredible player.
It's something that would crop up throughout Northern Ireland's history, and I was only thinking about it this morning when I was thinking about doing the podcast. But and obviously we'll talk about them as we go on through the decades in other podcasts. But for a country that's so small, it has produced a string of players going back 80, 90, 100 years that just were that weren't just great players, that they were phenomenal players, just world-class players. And for a country that's so small, they turned those kind of players out for a very, very long time.
Start even with a man who's just turned 80, Pat Jennings, arguably one of the greatest goalkeepers of all time. George Best, arguably one of the greatest footballers of all, definitely one of the greatest footballers of all time, 100%. Arguably the greatest footballer of all time.
Well, Pele was asked who's the greatest player you ever saw play, and he said George Best was the greatest player I ever saw.
Well,
play.
Okay, you would have to think he knew a little bit about football, wouldn't he?
When the football god says it's George Best, you should probably take it as pretty much given.
You got to like Peter Doherty, Denny Blanchard, some legendary players, and I'm probably forgetting some as well. But then you go back to the likes of Joe Bambrick. What a player he was. What a goal scorer he was. And the goals he scored. And I mean, that 6 goals against Wales is still a record for these islands. Nobody in these islands has scored 6 goals in an international match before or since.
We might get onto it in different podcasts in the future. But like having those kind of those three strikers, I suppose, alone in and around about the same time must have been extraordinary entertainment on the weekends.
Well, yeah, so they were all scoring goals in the Irish League as well. I mean, Joe Bambrick did go over to Chelsea, but they were scoring incredible number of goals in the late 20s, right into the 30s. And I mean, it was goals galore. It was a golden era for the Irish League, and it's probably a subject for another podcast, but I mean, you'll get arguments which of them was the best, and you have club loyalties and everything and that. But I will just say there were some phenomenal players. And I will also mention Jimmy Dunn, who was probably the person that kept Fred Roberts or even subsequently Sammy Curran out of the national team, because Jimmy had some incredible goal-scoring feats at Sheffield United. Obviously, the Dublin-born player who also scored, I think was 11 goals for the Republic of Ireland, became or was for many years the all-time leading goal scorer for the Republic of Ireland. But he played for Northern Ireland, scored some crucial goals for them as well. He was an incredible striker and has to be up there in the argument for, certainly for an all-time Republic of Ireland 11. I mean, okay, you have to start Robbie Keane with his 68 goals, but there's a strong argument that Jimmy Dunn would be his striking partner from his goals per game record. And more than a strong argument, a very, very strong argument. So
yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. So we make our way into the 1930s, and as you mentioned, they start off with a bang against Wales, don't they?
Yeah, so that win, that 7-0 win over Wales in the 29 home championship, it did only avoid the wooden spoon, although there was still a trip to Glasgow to come after it. But it actually put Wales rock bottom in the championship. So, but quite an achievement. There had been the first defeat at home to England. Actually, the defeat in October 1929 against England in the 29-30 home championship would have been Northern Ireland's first home defeat against England, I'm pretty sure, since 1912 in Ballymun Park. So that would have been, I appreciate it was war interrupted, but it would, I'm pretty sure I'm right on that. It would have been a 17 years unbeaten home record against England. Of course, well, what is it now? Have England been back to Windsor Park since David Healy? I don't think they have, but they haven't
too
played.
Scared. So. They don't want to go back, too scared.
So, but that would have been quite an incredible record in those days. So, went on to the, unfortunately, 1931, it was bottom again of the home championship. A creditable home draw against Scotland, but a defeat in Wrexham on the last day meant Wales avoided the wooden spoon. So there might have been a lot of goals being scored, but it was a case of Northern Ireland struggling, really, and all the other home nations. I mean, Wales won quite a few home championships in the 20s and 30s. Scotland and England obviously won quite a few as well. England would have won it in 1930. Then England won it in 32. Scotland won it in 31, etc. Wales won back-to-back in 33 and 34. So, I mean, unfortunately, it was Northern Ireland, the ones that were suffering. The odd win over Wales, a 4-0 win over Wales in 32, avoided the wooden spoon again. Sorry, in 31, December 31, in the 31-32 season.
Yeah, you mentioned some great players there earlier, and odd that they didn't win a home championship since 1914. They wouldn't win it for another, 36 years or something later in 56 was the shared.
Was only the shared one, yeah. So they didn't win an outright home championship from 1914 until 1980. And then, of course, we will have to go on and talk about that. They won it again in 1984 and remain however many years on. I don't even want.
So where's Northern Ireland football going in the meantime then? Because you get this kind of smattering of great results throughout the 20s and 30s. You get some really kind of big results away from home as well in the 30s. So it seems as if it's kind of, it's got good players, but it's not able to put the final puzzle together.
Yeah, you'd have to say the other home nations would have been very strong as well, you know. I mean, there was a notable win in Glasgow in September 33 and the opening day. And a draw with Wales, actually, was the only points Wales dropped in winning the 34 home championship. But it's very hard to put, I suppose, three games together when there was some very strong English and Scottish teams in particular. And Wales, obviously, were certainly in some years were incredibly competitive. But there weren't too many, you can maybe pick out one or two. There weren't too many heavy defeats. see a 4-1 defeat by Wales in Wrexham, 4-0 by Scotland, I suppose, in 32. Mm. Maybe England got 6 in 31. So there might have been the odds, heavy one. Maybe it was later into the 40s and 50s where some of the heavier defeats came in. And obviously in the early days, there were some shocking results as Northern Ireland were just starting out in international football. I suppose it was an incredibly competitive time. It was hard. I mean, in 34, the win over Scotland in Belfast meant Scotland only shared the championship. Scotland won the other two games. They beat England in Glasgow, but their defeat to Northern Ireland meant to share the championship with England. But that was the only win Northern Ireland got. They lost England and Wales. So it was a case of the odd really great result without ever putting a three-match campaign together to actually win a home championship.
It seems as if I dare to say it, but there is similarities in that with, I suppose, the Republic of Ireland as well, in that there would be times when they'd win a game and the expectancy would be high and people would go, geez, we could be onto something here, and all of a sudden you just this row of losses just come in, sometimes to teams or matches that you probably should win, etc., with your chances and stuff. So there is that kind of similarity there where the expectancy of winning and the hope of winning was probably greater than what actually happened on the pitch.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's probably fair comment. And now they were up against tough oppositions, but unfortunately, none of the home nations, I mean, the World Cup started in 1930 and none of the home nations didn't enter in 30, 34. Or in 38.
It seems like now, when you look back on that now, it just seems like such a waste, you know, to not take the opportunity to go to a massive tournament. I suppose it wasn't massive at the time, but in terms of the history of your country in their footballing sense, not go to a World Cup when the opportunity arrived so easily to do so seems frustrating, weird to us now, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to look back. What's almost 100 years now. I mean, the centenary of the World Cup is coming up in 5 years. It's very hard to look back and see, I suppose you're looking at things through a very different prism.
Mm, yeah.
But it does seem strange that the World Cup and even internationals, I mean, England and Scotland were regularly playing foreign opposition at that time as well. But the IFA, they weren't inviting teams. I mean, the next team to Belfast, I think, was France in 1951. They were still just playing the home nations. The other games were incredibly rare against other nations, apart from England, Scotland and Wales. And as you say, it's strange they passed up on the opportunities to try and qualify for World Cups. And you have to think they would have achieved it.
Is there any insight in terms of your footballing history, knowledge or insights? Is there any particular reason why there is this hesitancy to play non-home nation teams, in that it seems like that's the only thing that they wanted to play, and they didn't seem too bothered to play about playing a France or an Italy or, you know, like something like that?
I don't know. I mean, the short answer would be I don't know. I mean, maybe some of the ideas could be that the Norwegians had to prepare for all the expenses. Back in 22, they did offer a return match, but the IFA just decided to take the expenses. And so they were willing to pay at a no cost. But it does seem strange, even with all the teams coming to Dublin in the 20s and 30s, that none of them would have gone north, you know. I mean, when the Republic of Ireland eventually got to play England in 1946, it was on the back of them playing in Belfast on a Saturday, the 28th of September, and then they came to Dublin on the Monday. So you would have thought that the countries like Hungary, Switzerland, Germany, Spain, Poland, all the countries coming to Dublin, Belgium came so often, the Dutch came to Dublin, all those countries coming to Dublin in the late 20s, early 30s, that it seems strange none of them were invited to to play in Belfast, but I'm not aware of any discussions, or probably you'd need to ask maybe some Northern Ireland football historians the real reason if it's not lost in the midst of time. But certainly they seemed quite happy just to play in the home championship. But as in the case of the Norway game or the South Africa game, when South Africa came on that tour of these islands, they were certainly willing to play teams. So it's hard to know.
Yeah, I suppose part of it as well, you're playing England and you're playing Scotland, probably two teams that are considered in their minds as well, two of the best teams in the world. So it's kind of a little bit of give and take. You're playing what you consider to be two great teams anyway. So where's the purpose in trying to find, you know, something that's out there that might be something better?
Yeah, and I think that's definitely fair comment. I mean, they would, England and Scotland, and I mean, Wales won, they won another home championship in 37. They had quite some talented players at the time as well. But certainly, I mean, if you had a time machine to go back to the 1930s and you were asking people who's the best international football team in the world, most people probably would have said England or Scotland. And it's hard to judge how good Northern Ireland were and how they would have considered themselves in those days. But certainly, I mean, England and Scotland would probably consider themselves above the teams that would have entered the World Cup.
We roll on into the past the mid 30s as well, and it's here that we kind of, obviously we know it to history, but we begin to kind of see the specter of war begins to build within Europe, and of course Northern Ireland is part of the British Empire, so it's beginning to kind of, I suppose, become evident that there's a serious situation brewing, and Northern Ireland might be on the front line of that.
Yeah, I suppose maybe that's more in the later of the 30s at this stage. Obviously, Northern Ireland was hugely affected by the war. Mm. But the home championship certainly rolled on as normal right up to 1939, to April. The 38-39 home championship finished as normal. Unfortunately, it was a case of, if you take Northern Ireland, just avoided the wooden spoon. With that win over Scotland in 34-35, unfortunately finished bottom again in 36, did beat Wales in Belfast on the last day, but still finished bottom, because Wales had actually picked up 3 points. They actually cost Wales the home championship with that win, because Wales had beaten England in Wolves and had drawn with Scotland in Cardiff. So had they won in Belfast, they would have been home champions. Wales won it again the following year. Northern Ireland finished rock bottom, lost all three games, including a 4-1 defeat at Wrexham when Wales did clinch the home championship. Following year, it certainly was a bit better the following year. A draw in Aberdeen, which is quite an impressive 1-1 draw, and a 1-0 win over Wales in Belfast in March 38. So it actually meant Wales ended up bottom, as England were champions. There was a 5-1 hammering by England in that home championship as well, by the way, just to
remind them that a bit.
Remind, I suppose. I think just to be complete, the 1939 home championship was shared three ways, but unfortunately it meant Northern Ireland didn't get a point, and they conceded a lot of goals. A 7-0 defeat by England in particular, 3-1 defeat in Wales, and a 2-0 defeat by Scotland. Mm. So the championship was shared. Wales had managed to beat England in Cardiff in October 38. So everybody beat Northern Ireland, and England beat Scotland, Scotland beat Wales. Yeah.
And obviously then we go into 1939, and that's when football stops essentially for about 7 years ish because of World War II. I know it's because of the war, but am I right in saying there's league football still happening in Northern Ireland, club football, during that period?
Yes, so what club football did happen, but what actually happened, it was considered a regional league. So instead of the Irish League, they called it the North Regional League. And a lot of the provincial clubs actually had to withdraw. So I'd have to look back on the exact record, but the likes of Glenavon, Newry Town had been in senior football in the 30s, and they went out in the 30s. But certainly it became, for the 40s, more of a Belfast league, because I suppose there was travel costs. Northern Ireland was certainly north of the border, they were very much more affected by World War II than we were in the Republic. And I mean, there was rationing for butter, rationing for food, etc., north of the border.
I mean, there would have been rationing for there would have been rationing for petrol and fuel and all that kind of stuff. So that would have thrown the whole kibosh on the travel anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And whereas the league south of the border, football continued more or less as normal, and there were teams from Cork and Sligo did have to go out of football in the 40s, all right. There were certainly provincial teams playing south of the border, but north of the border, it was mainly the Belfast clubs. It was Linfield, Glentoran, Cliftonville, Distillery, Belfast Celtic, etc.
So how do we sum up then the 20s and 30s for Northern Irish football then?
I suppose you would have to say they were the least successful of the four home nations, but you can certainly throw in some incredible results and some great days. The wins over England in 23 and 27, that run of number of draws as well. Those wins in Glasgow, that great win at 28 at Partick Thistle, went again to Glasgow and won in 33. You have to talk about Joe Bambrick and the six goals, the 7-0 win over Wales at Celtic Park. So there were some incredible moments, but unfortunately, there was never a season when they could put everything together to actually win or even share a home championship. So given that Northern Ireland entered the period as reigning home champions, probably those two decades in general would have been seen as a bit of a disappointment.
Absolutely, yeah. But as we'll talk about in future podcasts about Northern Ireland football, there was brighter days to come, some much more brighter than others down through the decades, but they certainly made a good account of themselves in the future as well. We'll also be talking about some Northern Ireland club football as well down through the decades, maybe talking about some of those great teams that came from there, and some, as we've discussed before in other podcasts, some great European nights in there as well for some club teams too. But our first foray into Northern Irish football and the international team is our podcast today. And Gary, as ever, thanks very much for your insights and the great kind of look at Northern Ireland football as we kind of move into that.
Thanks, Gil.
Well, that's it for this week's show and our first foray into Northern Irish football. Remember to share the show on your social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. Make sure to turn your notifications on so you can get notified when the podcast goes live on whatever platform you listen to us on. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League team. It's our history, it's our game. Until next time, bye for now.